Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It's Monday, July 27th, practically at the middle of summer, and cool and cloudy out in the world out there, but we're hot and happening here in at Speak Up in the studio here at CJSF. My name is Magnus Tiewald. I'm your host for today, and joining me today
is Stephen Fan.
Stephen Fan, and I think Peter R.H. will be here in a little bit as well. But he hasn't arrived in the studio. His segment will be coming up at the end of the program. We're going to start the show off with an interview with Burnaby Councillor Meta Santiago about an initiative in that community to introduce a low-income transit pass. We recently reported on a similar initiative in the city of Vancouver, and others are happening around the region, so we're going to get to that in a few minutes. After that, we're going to head out to Nanaimo with a report from Lauren McKenzie about a silly boat festival. They've just had their annual bathtub races festival this past weekend in Nanaimo, so we'll be hearing about that. Of course, later on the show, just after the half hour, is Gardening with Embark, your weekly garden tips and updates. And of course, we'll be chatting with Stephen here about many things going on in the world. So let's get going with our first story from Danny Nezvedarani. Let's hear this one.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On July 14th, Burnaby City Councillor Maita Santiago put forward a motion advocating for a low-income transit pass. The motion called on Burnaby Mayor Mike Hurley to write a letter to the BC provincial government advocating for this change. The motion passed unanimously, and afterwards, CJSF reached out to City Councillor Santiago to learn more about what low-income transit accommodations in Burnaby would look like and what the personal importance of this motion was for her.
Yeah, so this this was actually first brought to our attention by Movement. So they wrote to us, you know, to let us know that this is something that they're advocating for. And then recently they also held a rally at the Metrotown SkyTrain station that I was able to attend. And when they raised this issue, it brought back to me my experience when I returned to Burnaby, to Canada, after many years overseas. And I remembered how, well, first of all, how hard it was to find a job after being away for so long. And when I finally had one, I remember going to the SkyTrain station, putting in my debit card, and then not having enough funds to cover like the two-zone fare to get to my new job. Luckily, I was able to, you know, walk a couple of blocks back home, find some, you know, some loose change and pockets and bags and what have you, get to my job. But so that really, you know, brought it home for me about how important something like this is. For people really just trying to get to work for the most part and really having not much else, I think it can make a really big difference.
During our conversation, we also learned that the motion and subsequent letter from Mayor Hurley calls on the province to expand the already existing BC Bus program, which is currently only available for low-income seniors and people receiving disability assistance from BC.
Yeah, so what we called for in our motion is for the province of BC to expand eligibility for its BC Bus Pass program to include low-income households across Metro Vancouver. So including Burnaby. So I think the bus pass, these subsidized bus passes now are about $45. So that's something that, yeah, that we would like to see for people in Burnaby as well as for people across Metro Vancouver.
This is not the first motion of its kind to pass throughout Metro Vancouver. A few weeks prior, Vancouver City Councillor Sean Orr passed a similar motion, and since our interview with Councillor Santiago, City Councillor Lubick of Port Moody has passed an identical motion as well, advocating for a low-income transit pass.
I think a number of other, cities have already passed similar ones, along with Vancouver and Burnaby. I think City of Langley has, and I think the City of Port Moody, through Councillor Amy Lubick, is also looking to do something similar. And as well, we know that other major cities or major areas, regions across Canada have, low-income bus passes for residents. So, yeah, is it possible? Yeah, I think absolutely.
The advocacy for a low-income transit pass has also been driven by Movement YVR, a Metro Vancouver transit advocacy group that held a rally on July 1st in support of the policy. Councillor Santiago had referenced this as a motivation for her motion, and it looks like other municipalities are beginning to follow suit. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
And we'll be back in a couple of minutes with our report from the Silly Boat Festival. After that, Stephen Fan is going to be commenting on just why the economies are growing at different rates in the developed world, particularly the United States versus Europe and Canada, and understanding what that's about. Peter Arich is here, and I'm going to get him to tell us what's coming up on his segment.
Well, I'm going to I did the aluminum information. What was it?
It was about a year ago or so.
So I'm going to go over a bit more of it because I noticed in the media that it hasn't really.
So what specifically? There's like aluminum production here in Canada, or is it, but it also I'm trying to remember back, right? Because it was also about the tariffs that had been introduced on aluminum.
Right. Various information. One is that the correct terminology is smelting it, because we get the compound. Brazil is one country we get it from. Quebec is the major province where this is happening, yeah. And British Columbia is the only other one, but it's vastly done more in Quebec, because in northern Quebec they can have the hydroelectric power created. That's known, that can, and the other thing is the United States, they actually lost a smelter during the tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they're going to perhaps get one at the end of this decade, whatever we call it, the other 20s. But they'll be partially funded by Dubai. So I don't know. I mean, more foreign ownership of the United States. The other thing is that many times it's coal production or whatever is doing it. Now, what's interesting, you know that there's podcasts about aluminum?
Interesting.
And I heard.
I guess there's podcasts about just about anything, hey?
Anyway, I'll have other information about this because I heard two of the podcasts on the aluminum podcast.
Excellent. Thing. Okay, well, we'll come back and talk about aluminum at about 10:48. In the news this weekend here in BC, the BC nurses have called off their job action after a couple weeks of limited strike action. They've accepted the mediator's recommendation, the recommendations from mediators Vince Reddy and Amanda Rogers. This was the longest nurses' strike in BC history, which I guess is good in the sense that we don't have
that
a lot
that it's
of...
it's over.
Yeah, good that it's over and that we don't have a lot of long nurses' strikes. The next step is binding arbitration, which is a process that could take several months before we get a final... final resolution to the strike. At the moment, we haven't heard details about what are in the recommendations, but it's good news for all of us.
This is Bird Note. Spanish moss hangs eerily from cypress trees rising from the black water of a Louisiana bayou. The water ripples where a slender form glides just beneath the surface. At first glance, it appears to be a snake. But look closer, and you just might see a long, narrow spike of a beak at the tip of a slender neck. It's a snake bird, a colloquial name for the anhinga, swimming with just its head and neck above the water. Anhingas belong to a small group of birds called the darters, and they look a bit like cormorants. When hunting fish, an anhinga hangs motionless in the water or swims slowly just below the surface, its neck crooked, almost like a cobra's. The anhinga has specialized muscles and a hinge in its neck. And when an unwary fish swims close, the bird's head darts forward, impaling its prey. Backward slanted serrations keep the fish from slipping off. Surfacing with its beak held just slightly open, the bird flicks the fish upward and catches it in midair. Then it downs it head first. And once again, the anhinga glides through the black water. As always, you'll find photos and videos on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
This is a CHY News update. All things fun and silly came together on Sunday afternoon for a regatta like no other. Down at Mafeo Sun Park on Sunday, July 19th, the Silly Boat Regatta celebrated its 40th anniversary, raising money for the Nanaimo Child Development Center. The center is a community-based not-for-profit that offers a variety of services and programs for children with developmental needs. The center services around 1,900 families in Nanaimo and offers most of their programming at no cost. It was a hot Sunday morning when over 30 different local organizations, businesses, and community groups built their ships using a variety of recyclable materials. Thousands of people showed up to the park to get a glimpse of the boat building process and to snag a good spot in front of the Nanaimo Lions Pavilion as children's entertainer and musician Fred Penner took the stage. Before the races, CHY spoke with Kimberly Howland, CDC Resource Development Team Leader and organizer for the event. She has been helping to organize the Silly Boat Regatta for 12 years and felt positive about this year's event.
Amazing, especially to see all of these people here and knowing, having Fred Penner be here and all the fans wanting to come up and see him. It was amazing.
Howland was also excited to see the boat created by 102.3 The Wave. Their radio station, previously called Chubb, was an AM radio station when they created the Silly Boat Regatta race in 1986.
I think the one I'm interested to see this year is Island Wave Radio because they've been doing this for a lot of years and have never won a race. So I'm hoping for them. I think the 40th would be a time to see them win a race.
As the biggest annual fundraiser for the Nanaimo Child Development Center, Helen says it's uplifting to see people keep coming out to the event and make donations.
This has been really heartwarming and encouraging because this event is not just a community event, but it's to help us raise funds for kids and families in the community. And seeing this many people coming out to help support our 40th, it's just heartwarming.
Soon the racers were off.
Three, two, one.
Crowds gathered around the beach to watch the racers dash into the rocky ocean and paddle as quickly as they could whilst trying to stay afloat. Shortly after, it was time for the championship race. The first team to ring the bell at the end of the course would be crowned champions. The Loyal Nanaimo Bathtub Boat Society, with their boat, the Monster from Snake Island, were able to ring that victory bell with the fastest time of 2 minutes and 15 seconds. Following their big win, CHY spoke with the winning team, made up of Ben Friday, Pete Jonker, Matt Prime, and Aaron Grant. After taking part in this race 6 times now, Jonker says it's been an amazing feeling to once again get to participate.
You know, we left it all in the ocean. We took it out there, we gave it 110%, and it all came together for us. It was a big day. Big day.
He said the secret to their success might have been the air cannons they added to their ship this year for some silly and fun hijinks.
The secret? Well, we got air cannons. So I don't know if you noticed, but we were shooting water at people. We had a little mishap, and our man Aaron got shot in the face with a bunch of salt water and seaweed. But aside from that, we were just hitting other boats. So I think that gave us an edge. Yeah, I think. It kept the fear in the eyes of our competition.
Grant says the team didn't even make it past the first heat for the last 4 years, so they knew they needed to try something new.
I guess usually our build is too heavy or it doesn't work or there's some complexity to the boat that makes it not go very fast. And then this was like a change. I was hoping to make a modification to the boat design, and Ben was reluctantly saying, yeah, sure, we'll redo the whole design. And this one had a nice... buoyancy and speed, so it really took off. Like, we had a record time, so it was surprising and amazing to do it and be successful for once.
Team leader Ben Friday has been competing in the Silly Boat Regatta for 20 years now. He says he first started competing simply because of how awesome it was.
Do you know anyone else that has more fun in Waterfront Nanaimo in the summertime? I don't know. It's pretty great.
But the races aren't quite over for this group. Over the weekend of July 24th to the 26th, the Loyal Nanaimo BAFTA Boat Society will be hosting their annual World Championship BAFTA Boat Race.
So there's lots of fun in the park all weekend next weekend. There's concerts, there's beer gardens. There's usually beer gardens anyway. Kids stuff happening, and then the race itself is on Sunday at 11 a.m. sharp. That's sharp.
This year's Silly Boat Regatta was bittersweet. As former longtime organizer and former resource developer for the CDC, Michelle Kocharik passed away at the beginning of the month, following a battle with cancer. According to the Nanaimo Child Development Center, Michelle worked at the center for more than 20 years. In a social media post, the center recognized Michelle's generosity, compassion, and remarkable legacy that will continue to serve the center and the lives of children. At a Monday council meeting following the race, Nanaimo Mayor Leonard Krogh recognized Michelle's contribution to the community.
Her long service to the Child Development Center was the subject of much admiration and respect. In that work, she touched the lives of thousands of parents and children with disabilities in our community. She was a devoted mother and grandmother to her large family, and she found her greatest joy in dealing with them, loving them, and providing to them an example of what real community is about. What love and compassion and empathy are about.
While official numbers are still being calculated, it's estimated this year's Silly Boat Regatta raised over $90,000 for the Nanaimo Child Development Center. For CH1 News in Nanaimo, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning.
And as mentioned, the International BAFTA, the Nanaimo BAFTA Festival happened just this past weekend, the Silly Boat Festival the weekend before. The marquee race in the BAFTA Festival was won by third generation bathtubber Jack Schlitz, who won the race in this year, won the race in an hour of 1 hour, 24 minutes and 40 seconds. Do you remember, Peter, do you remember when they used to do the bathtub race across the strait?
Well, they wound up at Kitts Beach.
Yeah.
That's what I remember.
Yep. It was a bit, it feels like it's more of a...
Where do they wind up now? Where are they wind
Well, now they just... They start and end in Nanaimo.
Oh.
Not as
impressive. There's something impressive.
Well, I think it used to be much... It felt like a bigger event because, now it's sort of a local Nanaimo event, whereas... Back in the day, they stopped running across the Strait of Georgia in 1996 for cost and safety reasons, which I can kind of imagine. Lots of boats would sink.
Can they 3D print like a lighter bathtub? I'm very curious about this because I'm on in Nanaimo a lot on summer weekends.
Yeah.
And I didn't know it was there. And if I had known, I would have absolutely gone.
What I was going to say was I actually saw a bathtub land at Kitts Beach.
Yeah.
One or two of them. How about you?
Well, I lived in Victoria at the time, so I never saw it. I saw it on the news, of course.
I didn't see it like every year, but I remember seeing it happening.
Yeah.
In person.
Yeah. So now you have to go to Nanaimo to see that in person, but it's still fun.
It's not that impressive because you're going across from Vancouver Island to Vancouver mainland. I mean, it's pretty silly and stupid, but at least it stands for something, I suppose.
But it's fun. I wouldn't say it's not impressive still. Maybe not quite as dramatic and impressive, but I still think it's, you know.
I mean, the bathtub is a heavy thing, so I'm actually quite a little bit scared. I don't know what's the actual mechanics and logistics of it. But I do like these fun boat things, like, you know, like dragon boats, bathtub races.
The Silly Boat Festival.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like I said, they stopped it for one, cost and safety reasons, because it was not that uncommon for one or more of the tubs racing across the strait, especially if there was any kind of weather to founder along the way. So, of course, they had to have lots of safety boats and not
safety bathtubs.
So, so it was a stupid thing to do in the first place.
I mean, imagine
but
the
that's
insurance premiums.
Being stupid is what makes it fun. Sorry.
Imagine the insurance premiums for the event organized. Nautical insurance.
Well, that may have been part of the cost they're considering, right?
Yeah.
You know, you gotta. I mean, insurance in all sorts has gone up many times over the years, and for a crazy but fun event like that, I'm sure that would also be an issue.
Can you imagine? I've always wondered. Imagine you're like the insurance underwriter or adjuster for a dragon boat race, and your like day job is going out there inspecting like dragon boats. It's kind of a hilarious job.
I imagine you got to get a specialist for that kind of marine thing.
Yeah.
So who started the Nanaimo boat race? Maybe I can find
it. Well, we're gonna jump to a different topic.
Good.
Good. And Stephen's gonna help us with this, because this is a stat I've heard reported a number of times, and when I was talking to you beforehand, I mentioned that it's something that gets reported sort of where I've seen it in passing, that the U.S. economy over the last, let's say, 25 years, you know, the starting point they reference changes from time to time,
mm-hmm.
has grown at a much faster rate than the comparable economies of the U.S. and Canada.
Europe and Canada,
the U.S. has grown much faster. And like I say, whenever I've encountered this statistics, it's usually been a reference, you know, part of a different story where the focus was elsewhere. And I've never seen the issue dug into as to why that is. What are the factors, what are the reasons that that's happened, and what are the factors leading to that? And this is something you know about.
Yeah, this is something that, you know, my background's in economics, and I also have a strong personal interest in the mechanics of economic growth.
Yeah.
So this is something I kind of have paid somewhat sustained attention to. And yes, there is a lot of internet debates about this on social media and elsewhere and so forth, usually by people with various political agendas of their own, but it is a meaningful statistic on its own. And Mark Carney talks about this actually incessantly. He would talk about, you know, how housing affordability is not just a matter of prices, it's a matter of prices against people's wages. So, like, these are real concepts. So I think the first thing to note is that there really are two large clusters of reasons. There's not, like, two specific reasons, but all the reasons basically fit into two or three large buckets. The first bucket is something people just genuinely ignore. It's just not known. And this is why I'm talking about it first. The first thing is just straight up oil and gas. What I mean by that is not that the United States suddenly became Saudi Arabia. I mean, it did, actually, but that's not the reason. There's a very mechanical, technical reason that oil and gas sector suddenly became a huge driver of the U.S. economy, which is that the U.S. used to be, I think, pretty much the largest or second largest importer of oil, international oil shipments in the world. I mean, at some point in the early 90s, late 80s, it must have been Japan. But And so it was basically, it's the picture people had. You know, oil gets on a tanker in Saudi Arabia, goes across the oceans, and arrives in Houston. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's the picture. And that was actually accurate. What has subsequently happened is this thing called fracking and shale. Mm-hmm. Remember, fracking used to be very, still is, very, very controversial. But there is, fracking has a very different quality from, say, the oil produced in Alberta.
Just so fracking is a process that basically allowed the United States to suddenly, relatively quickly, access and ramp up production of a lot of oil that had previously not been accessible.
Or like leftover in wells or stuff like that. People tend to think about amounts. People often think about barrels, but the real game changer about fracking and shale, and these are basically the same thing, is a production cost and startup costs. Yeah. So you build out a project in Alberta, oil sands, heavy oil, or Venezuela, or any of these places, it's a $40 billion investment, and production will take, I don't know, 6 years to start or whatever. I'm not an oil expert. But fracking is like you can start in a month. Mm-hmm. And then you know, the moment the oil price goes up at the pump, someone will quickly open a new fracking point or shale production. So the price suddenly becomes very, very, the production becomes very, very sensitive to price. So it no longer became the external constraint on the economy that it was, for example, during the great inflation, stagflation of the 70s. The great stagflation of the 70s is an economy slowing and then oil prices being high. Now what has happened is that the moment the economy slows, the consumers buy less at the pump or there's less industrial demand, prices drop, but like the fracking just keeps going and you know, like it's just the oil price no longer feeds into a significant inflation driver in the United States. And so this has allowed it much more than Canada and Europe. Remember, Canada really only has heavy oil and Europe doesn't have that kind of thing at all, more or less, except for North Sea, is essentially to basically ride out economic waves in terms of supply constraints much better than Canada and Europe. And this, so this is like a physical factor that nobody could have done anything about, and partially regulatory because, you know, the regulatory framework around fracking is much more permissive in the United States. I mean, this started under Obama, not Trump, remember. Than anywhere else in the Western world, pretty much. But the other second cluster of factors, and I think people have talked about this, is the tech giants, right? Mm-hmm. One thing that has happened is that the economy since the great financial crisis of 2008 has shifted from, you know, finance at the top, and, you know, you have all these things owned by finance, to essentially tech giants. And, you know, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Meta, whatever, you get the idea. The thing about that is tech giants are really a straight-up case of single-winner contests. Yeah. There can only be one Google. There isn't really the market for a second engine. Bing by Microsoft is not very successful. There really is only one Amazon. There isn't a second marketplace. Shopify is less than one-tenth the size of Amazon. Yeah. It doesn't come close. You know, there's only one Meta, right? And Meta owns every social platform and probably wanted to buy, in fact, not probably, did want to buy out or straight up knock out TikTok.
Right.
So there's only one winner. The United States is the biggest economy in the Western world. Mm-hmm. These generally originate in advanced Western post-industrial economies with high consumer spending. It's all going to be in the United States. So the single winner criterion means that everyone else gets nothing and the United States gets everything. And so there's nothing you can really do about this. And this is where the whole digital services tax comes in. And I will point out that when a country has somehow that is tiny and small, like Denmark, has one of these single winners, like they did with Novo Nordisk and Ozempic, their economy grows like gangbusters,
right?
Faster than the United States or something. Like Denmark was easily the fastest growing economy, I think, in per capita, whatever, in Europe, whatever, for a while. And it's one drug. It's literally just one drug. Like, what is the Danish export? It's just straight up Legos and Novo Nordisk Ozempic.
Yeah.
That was just, that's how